The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
It is my great, great pleasure to introduce my dear Dharma sister and friend, Sue Cochran. Sue came to Common Ground 12 years ago to learn mindfulness. She was facing her first serious cancer diagnosis while parenting three young boys, twins in kindergarten, and the oldest in first grade, while working on her judicial career. She started meditating. When Sue first came to Common Ground, she had over 20 years practicing the 12 steps of AA, and she went first to the mindfulness and 12-step practice meetings. It was new, just begun by Craig Vollmar, our beloved teacher, leader, and friend who passed away from cancer several years ago. Sue took introduction to mindfulness twice, she says, and was a regular at Metta Friday night practice. She went to many retreats here and at Holy Spirit. Sue started volunteering by cleaning the bathrooms and basement in the old building and moved into leadership positions such as the co-chair of the silent auction to raise funds for the new center. She was on the original committee with Mark and Craig that began the process for the creation of beautiful and diverse community-based groups. Sue's cancer returned 5 years ago. She was given a terminal diagnosis, and since then she's been with her family, husband, three sons, three cats, her beloved cousin Chris, and brother Mick, who flies in from New York often, and he and Chris are here today as one of her sons, Ben. Sue served on the family court bench in Hennepin County, Minnesota for 18 years after a career in legal services. After her appointment to the court in 1995, she pioneered a new model on her family court cases, which transformed the structure and practice of family court into a humane, client-centered model. 2 years ago, while she lived with what was deemed to be an inoperable metastatic brain tumor that failed to respond to either chemo or radiation, she co-designed an international symposium sponsored by the Fetzger Institute, focused on the challenge of creating family law models that integrated forgiveness, compassion, and love into family law and courts. This was her passion and the culmination of her life's work. She invited Sherry Maples, Tara Brock, and Alex Haley to spread the teaching she learned here to the international legal world. The new models are flourishing. Today, Sue is choosing to speak to you about how mindfulness and equanimity in particular has helped her be compassionately present with all of life's challenge, not just the big ones like aging, illness, and death, and the massive suffering in today's world, but also the challenges of living our everyday lives. And I would just like to say that since I've known Sue for a long time and known her in a number of crises, Sue's response is always to everything, just tremendous kindness and tremendous courage. And I just feel so happy that she's with us today. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Patrice. Thank you all. I'm very honored that the center would ask me to do this. And I don't have any Buddhist scholarship qualifications, just life and practice. And so I chose equanimity. It sounds almost legalistic to my legal mind. And it's in the four divine abodes, which last week, if you were here, Mark said, if we could just get our mind and our body to live in the divine abodes, everything would be beautiful. And there's love, compassion, joy, and then there's equanimity. And it sort of sticks out. But the definition that I heard from Joseph Goldstein is the one that I just can't get out of my head. It's the story of my life, and I think all of ours. So it's been defined, you know, as evenness of temper, and the first one is to look over. It's the Pali, to be looking over like you're on a mountaintop, looking with peace and serenity over everything. Almost like the mind of a judge, you would think you would want them to be up there unbiased, even-tempered, calm, no matter what is happening, like down below. The downside is many judges are distant and they do not get involved in a deeper way, and you can have what they call the near enemy of equanimity, which is apathy, distance, indifference. So I had a different path, and so the other definition Bhikkhu Bodhi came up with is to stand in the middleness of things. And it isn't upekkha, it's a different word of four little words put together. It's a synonym for equanimity. And I'm also someone who knows time is limited, and I have read that equanimity is the crown jewel. It's the direct path to awakening. It's the foundation of everything. So I thought, why not go right there, right now, today? And so in the middleness of things, I will give you three spiritual story arcs of my life. Childhood, the healing from addiction, very, very dark times that brought me to spirituality, and then here, the mindfulness practice. Before I do that, equanimity is also how are we stable with all the changes of life. And Buddha put it into eight words, four pairs of two. So we all know pleasure and pain, gain and loss, success and failure, and is it praise and blame? These are the things that happen every second almost to us, every moment. And if we get caught up and chase them or cling or push away, our whole life actually could be built on those things. People who go after gain, money, success, fame. I heard a monk say that's like building your walking stick to get through life on a shaky twig. It is going to snap. But if we go for equanimity, I'll go right to the theme of the talk. Is we can stand there like a tree. I know I've in my 61 years in Minnesota, I've seen many huge trees uprooted. So I have never seen a sequoia or a redwood, but I heard they go all the way back to the Jurassic. So I picture these trees that are there, and no storm, no anything can move them. The tree can move, but it's still there. So childhood, I would say the theme there, we had many gains and then a massive loss. It's probably a pretty extreme story. I have read many, many memoirs, I think, looking for a similar one. My brother Mick and I survived it together through our creativity, our friendship, our resilience, like a Titanic it was. And he's here still. I said I wouldn't mention him till the end in case I'm sad, but it's joy, tears of joy. So what happened was, speaking of the middleness, I was a middle child of two brothers, a year older, a year younger. I was even noticing I was born right in the middle of the 50s, 1955. So of course I tend to go to the middle of things. They had it all. They could have been a Life magazine cover. They worshipped Jackie O and John F. Kennedy. They had the appearance, the white picket fence, the beautiful home, three children in the Catholic school system. Dad was a rising star trial lawyer in St. Paul with a severe drinking problem, and it went downhill fast. We lived on an ordinary block. That's how we did it then, but we had more things than most. Mom was very generous. She was a beautiful woman, gardener, creative, lovely person. We had all, the swing set and even a merry-go-round that normally would be like in a park. You pump and go around. So she wanted all the kids there, and she could garden. We were all together. And he became extremely violent. He hurt her. We saw it. He destroyed every physical thing. My job, I was in the middle of this, to run around and shut the windows so the neighbors couldn't hear. I got so into the middle of her pain and suffering, I would say when I was about 8, Mom, when are we getting our divorce? And then she got multiple sclerosis. And Dad left us all with, the drinking. And he was kept terrorizing us. I loved piano. We had to go to motels, the typical fleeing of severe violence. So she called the priest to see, could we get this divorce? It's unsafe. It's beyond unsafe. And I saw her. Remember the black, some of you might remember the black phone with the dial? She's sobbing over it. I said, Mom, what's wrong? Now I'm 9. She said, the pastor said, if I divorce your dad, I'll be excommunicated. I can't go to communion anymore. And I loved the Jesus teachings. In fact, I agreed with everything he said. Love one another. We love the sinners. We love the betrayer. We love even the murderers he forgave right on the spot before they died. And I thought, how could a church kick out this innocent woman, my mother, and us children were so innocent? Why did God abandon us? And that became a mantra. Why did God abandon us? And when she said it, I don't think I said it out loud, but I thought, then I quit too. Solidarity with Mom. And I started losing my faith right there, because how could this be? And it turned out she didn't do it. He started it. He divorced her. He was an atheist who pretended to be Catholic to marry her and just had to sign a paper, I'll raise them Catholic. So he did that, and he was, we had one visit. He was supposed to be sober 72 hours before. He was as drunk as could be, endangered our lives. Mom said, never again. So from 10 on, I never saw him again unless he was trying to break in our house, sometimes with an axe. I'm not kidding. He was beloved by the bar and the judges. They did nothing. The mayor would take him home, say sorry, and nothing helped, nothing. So Mom went into a deep depression, darkness. She could not function. Our house went under. We couldn't let anyone in. But we put on our uniforms, we went out, and we got our straight A's, and that was who we were. We had these two lives. And then Mick and I had this creative world upstairs. I won't go into it, but you've heard of children who create imaginary worlds. It was so complex. I could talk for weeks about it, but we were not dissociated. We knew everything that was happening. In fact, we had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Remember, we were like detectives saying, well, Dad just said this, and Mom. Well, then she snatched and took it to her divorce lawyer. We never saw it again. But we knew. And so we ended up from affluent to welfare overnight. And we lived without utilities at times. And then we put on this appearance for the public. He died when I was 19. I saw him at my graduation. He looked like a skeleton in his old cashmere coat. And then Mom died 5 years later. She was very, very sick. She wanted me and Mick to take care of her, and the doctor thought she should go in nursing care. They did not have much then. Now we're in 1978. She said, I want to be home with Susie, my rock of Gibraltar. And I looked at him like, you can't possibly think this is okay. And he just said, well, if that's what you want, Esther. So we set her up in the dining room. We got some kind of chair that was like a bed, and I slept next to her. I quickly want to tell you, I had a beautiful French life, and I majored in French, and I went to France thanks to my French teacher, said, "Sue, you have a complex life." That was a really neutral, equanimous way of describing it. I told her everything. I couldn't speak French. I also was a mute child. I couldn't talk in school, but I could talk outside. She said, you're a great student. You're the best. You need to learn to speak. I said, I can't. I told her the whole story. She said, you have two brothers. They'll take care of her. So I went for 1 month. I loved it. I went back for a whole semester. I wanted to stay there and be French. I came home. I wanted to get a PhD at Stanford. She said, you're in. You just go. Mom said, please, please go to law school. Please go to night school and take care of me during the day. The same school my dad went to. And I had vowed never, never to drink. I started drinking. I went to law school. You do not have to make the same stupid choice as I did to get awakened. I went into it, again, deep in the middle of everything that hurt me. I had a boyfriend who abused me, and Mom died in home with me there, and that was what she wanted. And I'm very sorry that happened. I was sort of in denial. I thought she'd be there forever, but it happened my first year of law school. Then things go very dark. I will just tell you, I really started drinking heavily. I still graduated with honors. I could write. I could not live. I couldn't do anything but perform on tests. Then 1 month after I got my swearing in, I walked into my first AA meeting. People tried many times to get me to stop. I'd say, no, no, it's my psychiatrist. It's cheaper. I need it. I cannot live. I could not live without my alcohol. I tried to quit. I felt terrible. I could not. I never had a drink again. And I wondered how come I could go in there and never drink again. What happened? They said you brought a higher power into your life. It was the practice. They handed me 12 steps and said, practice these, that's all. Do not live from your personality. That was a relief. Do not live from your ego. Do not live from yourself. To me, that's very similar to the Buddhist way. I surrendered my whole life to that practice. And I felt kind of guilty, like those murderers on the cross. I got a free pass. You get to start all new, like a person who acted well their whole life. I was suddenly acting like that. And yet I knew I had a disease that at any moment, if I slipped, I would end up probably dead. So that was my first time dealing with the death of, my father. Like, why didn't he sober up? We don't know. They say we don't know. There's some unfortunates. Life did get worse at first, and this is something interesting about addiction, which we all can turn to avoid pain. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as mine. It said, if you have a drinking problem and you quit and your life gets better, no, I'm sorry, if you quit drinking and your life gets better, then you had a drinking problem. Well, mine got worse at first, really much worse. And it said, if you quit drinking and your life gets worse, then you have a thinking problem. And I certainly did, but it had something for every single problem I had. It's like a giant toolbox, I called it, and every time I needed something, I could get a new thing. Like, the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. They are not abstract principles, like in law, the equanimity, the justice, and all that. It can be abstract, but we want to see real, real work. And then the cancer came, like Patrice told you, and it was unbearable, that if I lost my mother at 24 and it was that hard, how could that be? They were adopted as well. They'd already lost a mother and a father. Lose me when they're 5, 5, and 6, I couldn't bear it. I went deep into everything I could find. I needed even more. Even AA, the God thing, bothered me a bit. I used higher power, was my fellowship of my friends, the program. But I went out all the way to California to Commonweal. I was going through the treatments. And I learned about, there may not be a cure, but there can be healing. And I learned to meditate out there, just an 8-day intensive with 8 people, some dying, some like me, first time. I had a very dramatic diagnosis. It had been misdiagnosed for 2 years as a lump. It was cancer the whole time. Very aggressive. It could have come back within 2 years. I was preparing. Again, I was sort of prepared for that. It was, again, awful. That's when I came here. And I was a bit afraid of Zen centers. I'd heard, like, if you walk in on the wrong foot, you get in trouble. So have you heard of that? And I thought, well, I'm going to come in like the side door into the 12-step group. And there's Craig. And I'll just, he read a poem the very first day. I want to read it to anyone who is struggling and worrying about, sorry, I forgot my papers at home. So I am going to resort to this little technology. I think you've heard it. I hear it in the Buddhist circles. But I came in worrying, I'm a bad person. I've done wrong. I've lived terribly. They're all so Zen here. I don't deserve to be here. I was thinking that. And here's what he read. Wild geese, tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Oh, I'm sorry. That's an excerpt. It starts with this. This is what got me. You do not have to be good. It's the first line. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. It calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. I just have to thank Craig for that. And I remember he said, harsh and exciting with such gusto. I don't know if anyone saw him do his Roy Orbison imitation here. He was a humble human. I heard Shelley call him that. And he was also a lawyer. 1 out of 3 people were in that one generation. But he was my entry point to the center. And then I took the introduction. So I will be concluding here so we have time for you to share. See the time, Patrice, do you know how much time?
Yes, 11:26.
Okay. I'm going to wrap it up then with this. It turned out that the practice I did in my courtroom, I boiled it down to 5 principles that went international, are the same 5 that I heard are being used in Zen hospice. They're the same 5 that if I were to choose how to live, they're the ones I would use. And so it's coming together beautifully. I was not a judge who sat in the black robe on the bench with the armed deputy in the courtroom. I had all that. I asked the clerk one day, please, how do I see people? I come in, there's files this high, they're fighting the affidavits. I was in divorce court. I went right into the middle of divorce court. I forgot to tell you. Child abuse, domestic violence. I had to go there to find, I guess, my own healing. So I said, how do I just meet people, like face to face? She said, I'll get you a flow chart. No one's ever asked for one. It came back this convoluted boxes and arrows, and it would just give you a migraine. There was a box that said limbo. It went nowhere. So if you had a bad lawyer, you could end up in limbo. But truthfully, and then she had a perfect square start here, like a board game. I said, I wrote a letter at start here. I had them come in, two people. We had a duty to educate. We were doing a one-size-fits-all movie. I thought, I'll just tell them what it's like. And I told them. I said, 95% settle before trial. I can tell right now you are not in that 5% that will be in a trial. Would you like to hear a different method? And I had a room set up. I fought months to get a little room next door with, brought in art and rugs and lamps. But I showed him the chart, and I said, you could settle up here. You could put all your energy here, save all this stress, put your own kids through college instead of your lawyers. And 98% chose it, and that's when I had my 15 minutes of fame. Then I had cancer, then I left, then they changed it up, a little more litigious, but it's still there. We now meet with people before they go into the acrimony. And so that is life for me now. I made none of this up. We move to the pain. We don't run from it. We don't numb from it. We move closer. That's equanimity. Go right into the middleness. And then we open. And that's where the love and compassion are. And when I hear emptiness, I think dry, empty mind. When I hear empty mind, I sometimes worry. But then I listen to Dharma talks all the time. Even if I'm not physically here, I listen in. A monk said, the empty mind is not empty. It is like a flawless and radiant piece of crystal, glowing and radiant. Whatever comes in, it can transform into the beautiful prism. So it can filter and make loving kindness come. So that is the message that I want to leave you with. Don't be afraid to go in. And if life drops suffering and things happen, our practice is to be with it and know that the one thing that does not change is that crystal, flawless, strong, unbreakable equanimity in our mind that is always there. And it will help you transform anything into love. And the reason I brought up the divorce is to tell you this. 95% of them didn't need a trial. 100% of us are going to die. So let's not wait to the very end on the steps of the courthouse. We'll just start practicing it now and have a very mindful death. It may be messy, it may be painful, but it's a smooth part of our life. It's part of our life. So I will end it there because we have a really nice directional mic. You can share your stories of equanimity, anything that you feel moved to share or ask. I make sure we have time, and we have a reception with some things after, we'll tell you. The time is good. All right. We have a good amount of time. Would anyone like to say anything they're thinking of or a question or comment? Okay, Stephen, and you just hold it straight at your mouth.
Well, first, thank you very, very much for your open disclosure of your life like that. It was really moving and inspiring, so thank you. No, I just was curious about the five principles that you mentioned.
Oh, thank you. The first one is inclusivity. Welcome everything, push nothing away. The second one is listening. Hospice people, the Zen teacher, Steve Ostasensky. He has a good interview with Tara Brach. That is so worth watching. He said, the dying will tell you how they want to die. Listen to them. I listened to our mother. She created her own hospice. So beautiful. So listening, generous listening, listening so well that people will take their masks off in front of you. The Carl Rogers kind of listening. He knew suffering, so he could be there for anything. We're all in this together. So, okay, inclusion, listening. I know the end one. I want to think of the middle one. Well, I might have to skip one here. Sorry, I should know these. Space, giving space to everything. That's the space. And in my world at court, it was physical space, design, art, space. Change is another one. Everything's changing, and that could be innovation or being okay with change. Things are always changing. And there's one more. I may have to leave that to the mystery. If you are interested, I do a blog. It is called The Movement of Healing. And I owe that to Bob Williams, an artist. He came up with that title. But the whole Fetzer article is on there. So thank you for asking. I got 4 out of 5. Thank you. Anyone else want to ask or share? Yes, and if you don't mind saying your first name, if you're okay with that.
Hi, I'm Cameron.
Hi, Cameron.
While you were talking, I think I just had this thought that I think everyone has a lot of experiences in life, and I think the first thing we like to do is blame ourselves. You were speaking of how when you came in, you know, the first things you would think is, "Oh, I'm not worthy. I can't do this." I think a lot of people forget where we put a lot of our problems are within ourselves before we blame other people. And so I think the very first step of compassion is forgiveness, and not just forgiveness of other people, but the ability to forgive yourself. And I wanted to share with everyone a quote that I found, and it was that a man asked a Indian Sufi what forgiveness was. And he said, forgiveness is the fragrance that the flowers make when you step on them.
Thank you, Cameron. Thank you.
yes. I said the quote was that a man asked an Indian Sufi what forgiveness is, and forgiveness is the fragrance the flowers make when you step on them.
Mm. So. Thank you so much, and thanks for the reminder of compassion to ourselves first. That's key. Thank you, Cameron. Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Kit.
Hi, Kit.
Your father was a very public person. The mayor was interacting with him. Can you share a little of the coming to terms with that external powerful person, and almost the outing of coming to terms with the complexity of that person?
Mm. Well, thank you for asking that. You hit a nerve. When I became a lawyer, St. Paul is a small town filled with lawyers. I had an uncle, an aunt, my dad, and the first thing they'd say, are you Hamilton or John's daughter? Hamilton was my dad, this incredible, brilliant star. And they'd go on and on, the judges and the lawyers, and revering him. And finally, like I said, I had trouble finding a voice. I still can have trouble. But mute child to lawyer to judge to international symposium leader, now that's a miracle. But so the judges would come at me with these things and lawyers, and finally I had the courage to say it. I said, well, that isn't the man I experienced. I experienced a man who was violent, who beat our mother, who left us penniless, who I did not see after the age of 10. And they would just be dumbfounded. But I remember, I think I only had to say it once. The word gets around St. Paul. Don't mention Sue's dad. And but then I did something really different. The bench, I was in Hennepin County. They didn't know me. They kept saying, where did this person come from with all this good family law? And I would call up, hi, I'm a lawyer from St. Paul. They would joke, we don't have lawyers from St. Paul over here. But they did not know me. They still don't know where I came from. If they listen in now, they will. But they didn't care. I was anonymous. So thank you for asking that.
Sue, your story about your dad could be told about my mother. And I, when I was sober quite a while, I investigated her life, and I understood that it couldn't have been any other way, and I said, also, I understood. And that was a big point of understanding and healing that came for me.
Thank you. And is it Donna?
Sharon.
Sharon, I'm sorry. I think I met you last week. Thank you for sharing that very close kind of encounter. And yes, when I came into AA, I did struggle. Why did my dad not do this? I will share you. I looked up in the probate that he had been committed involuntarily over 12 times. And they say there are such unfortunates. But his death gave me life. I would say that now. Hi.
Hi, I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan.
For purposes of making a point, I'm just going to briefly evoke politics here. And, you know, so I, like a lot of people, I watch what's going on this political season. And I, you know, the funny thing, I know it's so, what I'm hearing is so harsh, so unskillful, but yet I tune in. In fact, I even listen to YouTube stuff on the way home from work. And it's a darndest thing, because I know this represents just so skillless type talk, and there's, to me, there, I don't have any more to get out of it, but yet I tune in. And I'm coming to understand through this that there's kind of a melded hot dish quality of feelings inside me that I just can't separate. And under circumstances, tuning into this plays into stuff that I still have a long ways to sort out. And there's something about the negative energy that I find energizing and all that, and reaffirming of my viewpoint. And, you know, through all this, I'm looking back and I'm seeing that part of myself, and I'm saying, that is just feeding to all the less skillful parts of me. I don't need to do that. And, you know, it's just the darndest thing. I know better, but there I am doing it. And I think there must be some similar qualities about that in other, like with alcoholism. In fact, my dad was an alcoholic. And I guess that's my point, is that there are just some things that are just so strong that it is so, even though I know the skillful thing is not to tune in, I still do. And I'm trying to find that courage, I guess, just to say, put it aside and just say, you don't have the answers. Equanimity is where you need to be, and have the courage just to watch those feelings. And I don't know, it's going to be a long time till I get there, but I can see it. I think that maybe that's the biggest thing, is I can at least see it through my practice, you know.
Well, Dan, if I may say so, people would have told me I was stupid to go into family court where all that pain was, you know, to remind me. I think, and I've heard Mark say, we're all kind of looking in, getting almost hits off it. But I, you know, I think moving into it is fine. In fact, you know, I hear, I know alcoholism and chemical dependency has affected many of us. It's in almost every crime, every painful thing. Well, I found out that Donald Trump's older brother died of alcoholism, his beloved brother, 10 years older. And you weren't saying that man's name. But I was getting Rachel and agitated, and I thought, I can't try to find compassion for him. I was working on that. And certainly, this he was handsome. He left the business. He was a pilot. I think there's a lot of pain in that man. And I almost see him almost fragile now. And to have your beloved older brother die of alcoholism, he was Fred Trump Jr. He was supposed to be the golden boy. Donald was second choice. But I just look at him now and feel compassion. It took a long time, though. I try not to activate that rage now. Thanks for sharing that. We're all, I think, going through things. Is there another question, comment?
Sharon again. And,
thank you, Sharon.
I'm reminded of Ram Dass, who certainly has been a big teacher of mine, who said way back when that he had a picture of George W. Bush on his altar.
Oh, thank you, Sharon. Well, we have a minute left for anyone who would like to give us a minute of wisdom. Or
well,
anything.
Yeah, don't set the bar too high here.
Believe me, you heard my life story. I didn't have a big high bar to cross.
So I just wanted to say that a woman who was coming here, she was diagnosed with cancer about a year and 2 months ago, and she's now in hospice, but she started coming here when she got the diagnosis. And she said over and over again how coming here and meditating, she'd come here in the mornings too, was a godsend. It really helped her deal with it. And I'm just amazed at her equanimity, really. And her, you know, she's sad to leave her friends and her family, but she's ready. And it was this meditation, this focus on loving kindness and compassion and appreciative joy and equanimity that made her or helped her have this just wonderful way of leaving us.
Thank you. And your name again, sir?
Oh, I'm John.
John, yes, thank you. You started the reception. Is that you? Which we have next. I forgot one quote. See, I did have papers, so I think my legal career is over. I show up with no briefs or papers now. Finally, I want to leave you with one short quote. Pablo Casals, does anyone know who he was? The cellist, 20th century. My Aunt Marie, my mother's older sister, took me when I was 14, right before he died. I got to see him. He could play three instruments at age four. He brought the cello into a solo instrument. He's a master of beyond masters. So I followed him because I saw him. He died at 96, but at age 93, he was still practicing 3 hours a day. And someone said to him, Master Casals, why do you still practice 3 hours a day? And he said, and I'll leave you with this, if you have any doubts about who you are or your practice, he said, I'm beginning to see some improvement.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.